We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Welcome back, everyone, to Perpetual Chess. We have a very exciting sort of special episode this week. It is something different and something I'm really happy to be doing. It was our guest, who, by the way, as you may have seen in the show description, is Grandmaster and trainer Peter Hein Nielsen. He's the 5-time Danish champion. He has a 2,700 peak rating. But of course, these days, he's best known as a trainer. He worked for many years on Team Anand, as we'll be discussing. And these days he works with Magnus Carlsen. And what Peter suggested, and I am, again, I'm really, really excited to try something different and to go really deep into something we don't get to hear about very often, is we're going to do an oral history of sorts of one of the most consequential games in modern chess history, which would be, as we record this here, it's May 6, 2020. It's almost 10 years to the day since the conclusion of the Viswanathan Anand Veselin Topalov World Championship match in Sofia, Bulgaria, where Anand, spoiler alert, successfully defended his title by winning with black in the 12th and final game of the match. So if Anand had drawn that game with black, the match would go to a rapid playoff, but he ended up winning. And Peter here, who, of course, as regular listeners of Perpetual Chess, of course, will have heard his name many times come up, as well as chess fans generally. But he was on the team helping Anand prepare. We've recently had Michael Oblin talk about that a little bit. We had Rustam Khuzemzhanov on the show, who was also part of the team. And over on the other team, we interviewed Ivan Cheparinov. So we're fortunate enough to have a little background about this match anyway, and hopefully if you guys haven't read up on it, you might want to read up a little bit, but I think you'll really enjoy this behind-the-scenes glimpse anyway. And we should say that working alongside Peter and Khuzemzhanov are Radoslav Wojcicek and Surya Ganguly, and a cast of special guests, as Peter will explain. So without further ado, let's bring Peter in. Peter, thank you so much for volunteering to do this.
Well, thanks a lot for being allowed to. It's going to be fun. I've listened to now some of your podcasts, and now I'm allowed to join it. So thanks a lot.
Oh, yeah, I'm super excited. I was joking with my friend Mike Klein. I wish I had a little more production where I could like bring in the sound effects and stuff when you set the scene. But we're not quite there, so we'll just discuss it.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So let's set the scene in the match. I mean, again, a lot of listeners will know a decent amount about this. I'll just tell you from my perspective, Peter, and then you can give the more informed perspective. But obviously, historic match, close match. Both Topalov and Anand, very dynamic players. And a lot of backstory, as Ivan Chaparinov and I discussed, there was the issue with you guys getting there due to a volcano in Iceland. And then just sort of the players weren't shaking hands after the match. So in addition to any world championship match, it's going to be super high stakes. There was a sort of buildup of misunderstandings or maybe mild animosity. I don't know if you would phrase it that way in the match. And then, of course, it's a world championship anyway. So just tension building and building. And then in game 11, Vichy has white. And he has a long, mildly uncomfortable draw, which keeps the match tied. And then there we are heading into game 12. So, and you guys had a day and a half before game 12. Is that right, Peter?
Exactly. Yeah. You're jumping into the right spot. Let's start from there, right? That game 11 has just finished. And normally, I mean, you play games of two pairs. So there would normally be a game after sort of 11, but it's exactly because it's the last game of the match, there is sort of an extra 3 day. So we have like 36 hours to get ourselves together. But you're setting the scene correctly. The score is 5.5, 5.5. And as you said, Anand was wide in the 11th game, but he almost lost it. It wasn't functioning very well in that sense. So basically, we were hitting kind of, you can say, a bit of an emotional low. It's clear that, well, you would like to win game 11, you have wide, but instead he gets close to losing it. I mean, as we will explain later, Vladimir Kramnik was getting part of the team, and he had prepared some specific idea for Vichy, but Vichy, you know, well, he had to play the English opening. He didn't know it so well. He played a dubious move just out of his preparation. And let's say Kramnik was getting nervous. So, I mean, there was a lot of, I wouldn't say tension, but pessimism in the team. And there was a lot of problems to solve and sort of to get back to optimism. But luckily, there was this 3 day of 36 hours. So I thought, let's try and go through that and sort of give an, as you say, behind the scene talk about it. I'm going to talk a lot about the seconds and very little about Vichy. And it's not because I think that seconds are more important. They're obviously less important. That's just what I know something about. What goes on inside the head of Vichy, you will have to ask Vichy about. So, I mean, that's what we're going to spend the next bit of time on, I thought.
Yeah, and of course, for Vichy's perspective, I highly recommend reading Mind Master. He does talk about this match a little bit. One quote that stood out to me was, he says about this match generally, not this moment in particular, but he said, it wasn't fun like it was in Bonn. Here we were miserable.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. And I also recommend Vichy's book a lot. I mean, it really strikes you as being a very honest book. I mean, I worked with Vichy for a long time. I was one of his good friends. I hope I still am and such. But it's clear that he's actually giving a lot of personal information that was very new to me. And I think it's the kind of, you can call it memoirs. I mean, Vichy hasn't quit, but he's not trying to become the world champion anymore. So he's basically speaking freely. And that's extremely interesting, because else you will try to keep your, cards closer to you and not really give away your weaknesses. But he's talking a lot about helplessness and how he felt at times and such. And that's very interesting. But when Vichy says that, Sofia was tough, but Bonn was a pleasure, there is some truth in it, but also some, let's say, untruth in it. I mean, we're going to talk about game 12 here. And as you rightly said, everything is at stake. Vichy wins it, he wins the match. If he loses it, he loses this match. So basically, I mean, a ton of money, but also, the world champion title, etc., is at stake. But nervousness there was less of. Vichy was much more nervous when he was leading with 2 points and 2 games left in Bonn. And that might sound insane, to you. But I think it's sort of, at that stage, you have everything to lose. I don't know if you remember, but Vichy was leading with 3 points. But then he lost a game with black. That can happen. But then you have only one white game left. And should you accidentally lose that, suddenly there is one game left. You're black. Everything can happen. And you're going to throw away the best results of your life. And there he was incredibly nervous. It's the only time we've had to go for a walk before the game just to sort of calm the nerves and such. While here, it seemed like, okay, you win or you lose, but it's a normal result. And we were trying to get ourselves ready for battle. So, I mean, this idea that, Sofia was a walk in the park and a pleasure, while Sofia was extremely tense, it's true, but not fully. I mean, I think this idea of, being so close to actually losing a great result in Bonn felt devastating. While in Sofia, I think we felt okay, it can go either way. Let's try and do our best and see how it goes.
Yeah, and one thing we should be clear about is Bonn, of course, we're referring to the 2008 World Championship where Vichy defeated Kramnik. So then here we are in Sofia, and you mentioned it's obviously a tense moment heading into game 12. And it's been a nervous match, but thinking back, Peter, to 10 years ago, so as soon as his first game is done, what's your immediate thought? I mean, Vichy sort of has alluded to, being happy with a draw as black, being the amazing rapid player that he is. Was your mindset that a draw was the primary goal?
Well, that would obviously be a good result, but I think it comes along as having the black pieces. Also, I think at in that match, white had won 4 games and black had won none. So, I mean, this was a match where white was completely dominating. So that was clear to us, especially also, we basically felt our opening repertoire of being crushed. Let's say in the match when Vichy became the world champion in 2007 and also in the match in 2008 against Kramnik, I think we felt that technologically we were ahead of the opponents. And that I think also has been confirmed afterward. We thought we were better with computer technology and had better computers and such. But in Sofia, we got some surprises. And I think during the match, we realized that they had access to much more computer power than us. And we basically started doubting our opening analysis. I wouldn't say we doubted it, but we had this, at least we had a talk and thought that, let's say they play some opening variation in a game. If we actually want to repeat that line, we are basically comparing who has the better computer, but we know they have the better computer. So we had decided we have this strategy of jumping around and surprising constantly. But that meant that, it was a good strategy, but we completely ran out of ideas. And, before the match, we had prepared the Slav and we prepared the Grünfeld, but Topalov was punching big holes in it. So, we basically had no ideas of what to do. And I think even before game 10, we had some talks and, we had it actually before every black game and didn't really know what to do. And it was more sort of, it was not that we were choosing things out of pleasure, but more we were discarding things and looking what was left and such. And Kramnik was a big help of breathing some life into it, but even his resources came to some sort of a halt. So before game 12, I think Vichy took the decision just to say, okay, it's going to be the Queen's Gambit decline, and let's try and work for scratch. So we have 36 hours to get that going. But Vichy describes it in his book that he just took the decision himself, like he did before game 11 in Bonn, basically to rid us of the burden. You can imagine that if there is a lot of back and forth, should we do this, should we do that, then 1 second will say one thing, one will say another, there will be a lot of friction in the team. But if Vichy takes a big decision like that, then it's done and he takes all the responsibility. As I remember it, we were a bit advising it well, but I think everyone was so tired of looking at the Grünfeld or the Slav at that point that we were just very happy to have to do something else. And but it's also an easy decision to say, now we do it. Then the point is actually doing it. And that had ups and downs, to put it mildly. But I think we were basically desperate and we were out of ideas. So we thought, okay, we're going to do this and then we'll do our best and see how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, and just mind-boggling, obviously one of the biggest games of Vichy's career to basically, and he was not a Queen's Gambit decline player normally, correct?
Not a lot. I mean, of course, he's played it a bit, and I think it's an opening he always had respect for, and well, also jumping a bit ahead. I mean, someone like Kasparov will say, okay, this is the opening of world champions and such. I mean, it has a good reputation. It has never really collapsed. You can also see in a later world championship match, Caruana was playing it against Magnus with quite some success, getting a solid position. So, I mean, it's an irrefutable opening. So if you have to sort of flee somewhere, at least you can expect that that's going to work. But of course, I mean, well, as you know, Vichy, at least in the later stages of his career, wanted to be a perfectionist. I mean, we spent months preparing, and then we end up that before the absolute most important game of all, we sort of sit down and think, okay, what are we actually going to do now? And we try to invent something from rather scratch. But I think also that's how matches develops. And well, at some point you run out of ideas and you have to react to that. And well, it was an interesting experience, at least.
Yeah, it kind of happened back to back with the English in game 11. And then.
Yeah.
But yeah, just for the more casual chess fans listening, I just can't emphasize enough how much I was struck in reading up on this match. I mean, obviously, openings are important at the elite level, but the extent to which it seems like you guys always have the sense that there's sort of a monster lurking behind any door, and it's dangerous to venture something new in a high stakes game.
Yeah, I think it also depends on the players. I mean, I think, for instance, well, we said that Vichy was playing against Kramnik, and now he plays against Topalov. They are both, they're all three very theoretical-based players. They put a lot of emphasis on the opening phase, and they like to prepare. So if both players want to make it a war of preparation, I mean, well, then you need tons of camps. You're going to have complicated games. You can also go in a different direction, as we saw with Magnus later. I mean, he beat Vichy in the matches, just he kind of ignored the opening phase, and then he tried to outplay him later, and very successfully and such. So it's very stylistic, but I think at that point in sort of world championship history, I mean, it was really an arms race where they will prepare for months for these kind of events. And, well, you also get a bit addicted to that. I mean, well, the good side was that we managed to help Vichy, you know, become better in the opening. But it also creates some kind of addiction that it's difficult to sort of get rid of. And you start of relying too much on your opening preparation and forgetting that you're the best player on the planet. And it has a flip side as well, I would say.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I mean, obviously, you would know better than I would, but it seems like, and this will come up later because I know you've alluded to a crisis point that we'll get to as we trace the timeline. But I wondered, I mean, the odds of any one position, I mean, obviously, I know that you're someone who studies probabilities a lot. So even if you find one hole somewhere, the odds, like, obviously, it's risky, but the odds it actually shows up seem like they would never be that high.
No, it's a good point that, and I think some of the younger players would do it like that. But for instance, Vichy is not that kind of guy. I mean, to actually go and play something he knows loses, I think would be very difficult for him. And that was really not how we were supposed to do things. I mean, well, there would be a lot of bluff, but we would call it, let's say, semi-bluffs in the sense that, well, you play some forced line. And let's say with white, it could be a forced draw, but you have some tricks and you hope that he will fall for them. I mean, many games preparation was like that. I think also after the match, we saw some of Topalov's lines and they were exactly formed by the same thing, that they are very complicated line checks with the computer and you're sort of trying to catch your opponent. And you are completely aware that the line is a draw, but well, you don't care because it's very difficult for the opponent. But sort of to play things that actually is losing, I don't think is really Vichy's style. And if that was what the question you were saying, but I think you are sort of, I mean, going into the right question, because the quest we had to do for this game was that, well, we want to prepare the Queen's Gambit, but the Queen's Gambit is maybe, let's say, relying on four pillars. I mean, there is the Catalan, then there is either the Nimso Indian or the one d5 mood order. And then there is Queen's Gambit with Bishop g5 and Queen's Gambit with Bishop f4. And I guess your question is what happens if three of them works, but one of them is crashing.
Right, or even deeper into the variation tree.
But that's basically what happens. I mean, this night we're going to talk about, I mean, well, we were completely obsessing about some position, between move 14 and 16 in some line. And you're completely right. It had absolutely no relevance for the for what's going to happen. But for us, it was very important. And also, well, Vichy was aware of the problem. If we don't solve it, he's going to be insecure. Maybe he will freak out or do something else. Who knows what's going to happen? I mean, so we put in an absurd amount of energy on that. But you are right, from a probabilistic point of view, you could argue, okay, it's very unlikely. Let's just live with it. But it's easier said than done, especially when your whole career is online.
Yeah, and you're like, stressed and sleepless. And
yeah. No, that's also a good point. I mean, well, as you said, this is after game 11. I think we have been in Sofia for 3 weeks at the time, and the schedule is like two games and a day of rest, which basically means that, I think the players has to absorb a ton of stress, but at least they get some sleep as well. But I'm sure I have no idea how it is to be a player. It's probably quite ghastly playing a World Championship match, although it's every player's dream. Right. But of course, you're going to be stressed. But well, for us seconds, it was tough because two out of three nights, we were getting very little. And then, of course, you try to catch up when there's a free day. But you're basically turning into zombies, like an event like this and such. And I think I recall one night I saw sort of Kasimjanov drinking some kind of extremely weird fluid, and I asked him, what is that? He said, it's a banana schorle. And that drink doesn't exist, but I don't know if you know what a schorle is, but it's very typical German. You're mixing a kind of fruit with gassy water, but it would be normal to do it with apple juice. I mean, apple schorle is a very classical drink. Banana schorle, I've never heard of. But basically, people start disintegrating, and we are living in our completely own bubble. The place we lived, in principle, would be extremely beautiful. We had the top floor suite of the Hilton Hotel in Sofia. I assume it doesn't get better than that. I mean, you can imagine a huge sort of four-room apartment. Normally, it would be very luxurious. There would be a bar. There's a spa area and such. But we had basically removed everything. So there was there was a work table where the 4 seconds would sit. And then in the other part of the suite, there would be a table for Vichy where he could sit and work. And basically everything else was thrown out. So, there was a beautiful view. But, sunlight will get into your computer screen, so you will draw all the curtains. I think there is a couple of pictures where it looks like a very bad basement, but it's actually the top suite of the Hilton. But, World Championship matches tends to have this kind of effect that somehow, you try to lock yourself in. And I think it was a very good strategy because, if we talk a bit about the sort of the situation that Vichy is playing abroad, he's playing in Sofia. So while, at least from our perspective, we thought the whole world would be rooting for Vichy to win, then at least the whole Bulgaria was rooting for Vichy to lose. So basically, we tried to create our own bubble. And Vichy basically had a rule of to check internet. Well, maybe it's necessary for us. For instance, we need to know game comments. Maybe there is some comments about the opening, but to listen to rumors and chess politics, he tried to cut himself completely out of. So basically, we were trying to create some kind of bubble. And we did that in a sort of basically physical sense, basically sealing ourselves off from the rest of the world for good and bad.
Okay, you've done a good job setting the scene, Peter, of just how tense.
Yeah.
So before we start tracing the timeline from leading up to the game, I do have one question relating to the openings from a friend and supporter of the podcast. You're and a fellow Dane. I am Kari Christensen. So, he asks. He says, "Did the much frightened supercomputer, which Team Topalov were supposed to have access to, but in fact it didn't work, as Cheparinov mentioned in his Perpetual Chess interview, which you guys didn't know for sure at the time. But did the computer play a role in the thinking of Team Anand throughout the match and also in preparations for Game 12?
Well, heavily, but the actual supercomputer they mentioned, we didn't know of during the match. Actually, maybe they should have let us know, because then we would have been freaked out. But we knew about that they had this access to Team Ripka. And also there is a, at that point, we had understood that something like called remote computing was working, but we didn't have it on a big scale. And they had access to quite some more remote computing than us. We were reading some online forums, but especially, well, in the 2008 match, we were in touch with Team Ripka. But in 2010, they suddenly went silent. And I think we realized that there is two buyers for Team Ripka. And as it wasn't us, it was them.
Right.
So we kind of understood it. And I think after game two or three, we sort of decided that basically, okay, let's not make this a match of sharp preparation. But it fitted very well with our general strategy. I mean, well, you said originally that Topalov and Vichy are both great attacking players, and that is very much true. And Vichy used that to his effect against Kramnik. But our point of view was that Vichy is a global universal player, while Topalov is more sort of, one-way full-speed attack. So our idea was anyway to take him, you know, out of this attacking mode, and we wanted to play solid openings, and we wanted to, minimize the effect of opening preparation. I mean, basically, we thought Vichy is the better player, and, I think rightly so. So, I mean, a strategy that wants to take out sort of the effect of preparation, also to the same effect, is trying to minimize the effect of the supercomputer. So it kind of fitted to our strategy. I think we just decided to take it even a step further and simply, we were always trying to, force Topalov to think on his own, force him not to show all his computer-prepared lines. And, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, but that was very much the thinking.
Okay. So Peter, I want to get into the nuts and bolts of tracing the events, but first we're going to take a break to hear from our friends at Chessable. Listen up, Perpetual Chess listeners. I've got something great to tell you all about this week from Chessable. None other than world champion GM Magnus Carlsen is releasing a course soon, and he's got a free preview available right now on chessable.com. It features a 27-minute video going over a wild win of his against Super GM Lee Chow. In addition to the video, there's a trainable quiz from Chessable based on Magnus' games. And by the way, GM Peter Hein Nielsen, who you're hearing in this interview and is Magnus' trainer, helped design the course. So once again, the lesson is totally free, and all you have to do to see it is go to chessable.com and check it out.
Okay, so Peter, so you've got, once it's... Vichy decides he's going to go for the Queen's Gambit decline to the Lasker variation when possible. So what's the next step from there? You guys are assigned specific variations and each sort of work on your own, or what happens next?
I think actually, first of all, we tried to get a lot of sleep because there was exactly this free day before the next game. So I think the decision was taken after game 11. And then we thought, okay, now there's going to be a lot of sleep. And then we start working the next day. But, I think we were also trying to activate our sort of helpers and get in touch with them. I mean, basically, you said it's the Lasker, but, you say the Lasker because that was happening in the game. But, there was basically like four kind of areas. But, I mean, in some of them, we had some ideas what to do. In others, we were completely blank. So it was a matter of trying to shake as much information we could from the sources we had. And that was basically stage one, to try and make sure that also these four directions was basically kind of solved. I think one of the directions was the Catalan, but we had prepared the Catalan with white ourselves. So that was by far our least worry. But then we had to fix three other kind of things. And Kramnik, as mentioned, was basically already integrated in the team. So the first thing we were doing was to get to Kramnik and try to get as much possible info from him, for sure. But also Kasparov, Magnus, and so on. Maybe, I don't know if we want to do them sort of separately, what your plan is.
Yeah, I mean, well, let's dig in. I mean, again, this is something that's sort of become more commonly known as the years have gone on, especially with the recent literature about it. But so how did Kramnik's help come about? And what do you think his motivations were for helping you guys so much?
Yeah, Kramnik basically sort of offered his assistance, I think, after game three, if I remember correctly. He just got in touch via email. I think Kramnik has realized that, we were playing the Catalan, we were playing the Slav, which was his openings against Topalov. And he basically got in touch via email, to say that, why don't I help you guys? But I think, as I said, Basically, we saw it as the whole world was rooting against Topalov. And I think that's the right phrase. They were not ruling for Anand. They were against Topalov. And I think, well, if you remember, Kramnik beat Topalov in a match, but then lost to Anand the next match. But the Kramnik-Topalov match was basically, well, it was extremely exciting, but it was horrible in the sense of tension. Kramnik lost the game without playing, and there was this toilet gate. And, well, there was a lot of fighting going on afterwards. So Kramnik obviously really disliked Topalov, and I think, well, he just, you know, well, he would rather be the world champion himself, but seeing Topalov as the world champion again was just unbearable to him. So he basically just wanted to help Vichy as much as possible. And he basically, you know, sent us an email, maybe I can help you. And, well, we thought, well, we discussed it briefly, but I think everybody thought that was just a great idea. Yeah. So, well, he integrated as a full team member. Of course, in the beginning, maybe it was a bit more sort of, well, you know, we were testing out what is his motivation? Is he trying to get info from us? But it was clear that he was sharing a lot of stuff. But in the beginning, we didn't treat him as someone we trusted fully. I remember that I think before game four, he had shown us some interesting ideas in the Catalan. And we said, ah, that's very interesting. Thanks a lot. And then Topalov played exactly into this area, and we played something else, and we hadn't told Kramnik. So he thought, okay, what is this? I mean, I give you great ideas, and you don't play them. We're just trying to collect info or what. And we told him, no, actually, we had prepared this, and, well, we are sorry. But we started to share more with him, and also I think we shared some things about the technology. And I think in the beginning also we were not giving him the full truth, and we thought, okay, this is ridiculous. He's helping us. Let's, you know, just share everything with him we do. And I think also, well, it also depends, I mean, on sort of the strategy and such. I mean, well, imagine if you're very young, you expect a lot of world championship matches would happen later. But I think at that point, it was clear for Vichy that he thought that, well, it's not my last world championship match, but should I lose the title at some point, I'm not going to try and qualify again. Well, actually, he did, and he successfully, but I don't think that was the plan at the point. So I think basically we decided that we're just going to, I mean, the only thing that matters is winning this match. If you win it, there is a new match, and we prepare for that. But it you know, gives you the freedom of, okay, share whatever info you want with Kramnik, because that will make him feel more comfortable. He will help us more, and this will improve our chances in this match. So basically, well, he got access to all our files and such, and he just became a full team member. He was working for us at night. Believe it or not, he was actually playing a tournament at the time. I mean, I recall him, well, calling on his cell phone to Kasim Janov on Skype. I said, but Kasim said, but you have to play Radyabov in 50 minutes. Ah, don't worry, I will find something to play against Radyabov. He was just talking with us about advanced theory. And I think he even won the tournament and such. So he was basically a fully fledged member. And I mean, he solved a lot of difficult opening problems from us. I mean, he was an extremely dedicated second, and I think, well, he wanted Topalov to lose. Let's just put it like that. I haven't told him about it, but there's no specific reason he would want Vichy to win. But at that point, he was extremely tense with him and Topalov still. And, well, it was obvious he didn't want Topalov back on the throne. And well, I think rightly so. But Kramnik was extremely motivated in that sense.
Yeah. And for any listeners not as familiar with the history, obviously, you can just look up Toilet Gate chess, yeah. And you'll find all about Topalov accusing Kramnik of using engine assistance during a world championship, which obviously is the sort of thing that can beget a grudge. So that sets the scene for Kramnik. And obviously, he, as you say, he's staying on Skype calls throughout the night. And what about another former world champion, Garry Kasparov?
Well, Kasparov had sort of been around as not a helper for Vichy. But when Vichy was playing against Kramnik in 2008. Kasparov was also helping a bit. Not a lot, but they had like a phone conversation relatively shortly before the match where they sort of, well, Kasparov had played the Kramnik in a match, so he had some insights there. they were debating a few opening ideas and such. And well, also, if you remember, Vichy was playing a very surprising move, 1d4 in the match. And well, just to show that there was some trust between them, Kasparov was asking, so Vichy, what is your opening move going to be? And Vichy was saying, actually, it's going to be, well, d4 and such. So they were having some talks like that. And I think at that point, well, Kramnik and Kasparov had a very bad relation that they still had during the Sofia match. We'll come back to that a bit later. So that was his motivation then. But he was also offering his help for this Topalov match. And here he was somewhat more. I mean, before the match, I remember that Kasparov and Vichy was having a Skype conversation, sort of debating certain openings position. But as strange as it sounds, they were both not heavily into details. And well, that's maybe quite typical. I mean, well, Vichy also has to prepare his physical shape. He also has to prepare his calculation. And sort of 1 month before the match, he doesn't have to be fully into details, while I would be fully into details because that's my only role. And Kasparov was out of chess and such, so they agreed that, well, why don't you email me instead? So, well, what happened was that I copied some questions I gave to Vichy, who then sent it to Kasparov, who most likely gave it to his assistant. So in that way, I was kind of debating with Kasparov's assistance about some opening problems. But Kasparov was showing willingness to help there, at least. But Kasparov's things was a bit outdated at the point. And also, when we came before this game 12, Kasparov was still helping.
So, Peter, what do you think Garry Kasparov's motivation was?
I mean, well, a lot of it was chess politics. I mean, this is 2010. Kasparov was not running for FIDE president, but Karpov was running, and it was clear that Kasparov was supporting it. Also, at that time, Kasparov was Carlsen's second. And I think these two things combined. I mean, well, Danilov was Topalov's manager. And I think he was, well, I mean, Topalov was not really supposed to be in this World Championship match. There was some kind of, well, negotiations where Topalov was sort of parachuted into playing a match against Kamsky to challenge Vichy. I mean, basically, FIDE was giving him a huge political favor, and he only had to beat Kamsky in order to qualify for this match. So he was kind of connected to FIDE while Kasparov was trying to challenge it. Secondarily, I think that as Kasparov was Magnus's coach at the time, well, he was hoping Magnus would be the next challenger. And I think because of that, it was important for him that Vichy would win. Not that he thought Vichy was an easier opponent in any way, but should Topalov win, then well, with Danilov and the sort of potential FIDE leadership, it might be very difficult to sort of get good conditions for a match, or maybe even they would try some shenanigans. It was very typical at the time. While with Vichy, he thought that Vichy is chess politically rather weak. It's going to be easier, and well, they would just get a straight match, and he thought favored Magnus' chances there, I'm sure. So I think this was sort of, again, very politically, and especially as sort of Vichy is mentioning in his memoir, at least afterwards, Vichy got the feeling that Kasparov wanted him to endorse Karpov as the next FIDE president, and which Vichy refused to do. And then later, Kasparov was trying to help Gelfand for the next match versus Vichy, but that's jumping a bit ahead. So
I didn't know that.
No, I think, well, that was the story at the time, at least. But no, there was a lot of politics going on. I mean, well, there is always politics going around, but in 2010, it was very tense. And the match was happening, I mean, relatively few months before the upcoming FIDE elections and such. So there was definitely a lot of tension in that sense. But it's clear that Kasparov and Kramnik was very motivated to help. But the funny thing was that we really wanted both their helps, but also we couldn't tell Kramnik or Kasparov that the other one was helping, because then things would collapse, as you can imagine. Because, I mean, just to complicate things, they also hated each other. So it's basically some kind of weird triangle, right? And I remember at one point I explained to you that we have this suite, right? The seconds is sitting in one room, Anand in the other. And at some point before this game 12, I remember that Vichy was talking to Kasparov, and Kasabiana was talking to Kramnik, and I could hear both conversation. I thought, okay, maybe they can hear it. So I quickly ran up and closed the door, because I thought, okay, the least thing we need is to, you know, Kasparov starting to say, okay, I will help, but Kramnik can't help, or something like that. So, and well, also I had a conversation, I think, before we got Kramnik's help, where Vichy was saying, well, should I accept Kramnik's help because Kasparov will maybe be upset about it? And well, I thought, he's going to find out after the match. And that was basically end of discussion. I mean, as I said, we are trying to win this match. And what happens afterwards, happens afterwards. I mean, basically, okay, it becomes some kind of war thing. You are willing to lie or whatever you do. if they only find out after the match, who's going to care, right? But that was basically our two sort of world champions help us. But Kasparov was more general. He was talking quite some with Vichy. And I think for Vichy, it gave some kind of confidence. I mean, Kasparov was the stronger player than Vichy in most of their sort of career when they were face to face. And I think he somehow got some positive energy for him. While Kramnik was, delivering a lot of opening analysts to us. And he was also sharing ideas he hadn't used himself, but definitely would have been useful for him later. And I think he said something like, okay, I will just give you all my work. But the deal is, if we don't play it here, I will have the chance to play it first. But basically, he was just, it was a huge resource. You can imagine that Kramnik was maybe the best prepared player in the world. And he was just, you said he was joining us on Skype, but he was also just sending emails with his files and such. So, I mean, that was a very interesting experience and extremely helpful, obviously.
Yeah, and from what I've read, some interesting color earlier in the match with the Alista endgame.
I mean, well, that was a bit reversed. We thought the Alista ending was very good, but then Kramnik showed us all our problems. So, right. I mean, we got to a higher level of understanding, but we had a much worse opening. And but sometimes it's better to be, you know, confident and ignorant than to be fully aware of the problems. But that was a different story. But, at that point here, we had run out of things. But, I mean, Kramnik was especially responsible for in the... Well, it's called the Bishop F4 system against the Queen's Gambit, the client. We knew the different systems, but we had no clue what to do. But Kramnik was sort of suggesting that, the system with Knight H5 was very undervalued. I mean, now it's one of the main lines, or at least it was at some point. And at that point, it was very fresh, and Kramnik had sort of, he had prepared it. He thought it was very solid, and he basically showed us all the points there. And I remember being very nervous about it, and Kasimjana was having a Skype conversation with Kramnik, and I was sort of sitting there eavesdropping, but they were talking in Russian, so I had no clue what they were talking about. But Kasim was sort of at some point just on a piece of paper was writing Knight H5 exclam, and I felt much more relaxed because then I understood that, as I said, there was like four kind of corners we had to cover, and this one, we needed some kind of idea, and Kramnik was basically giving us a tons of notes, and also Kasparov will suggest some moves, some ideas, but Kramnik would more give complete solutions. And what you really need at this point is to seal off some areas and say, okay, this we can actually live with. Let's try and move on to some other problems. And if we had to pay Kramnik, he would have been extremely expensive. But luckily, he was working on spy. That's a huge, huge motivational factor. Right?
That's funny. So I know you guys had some other people chime in via Skype or other, internet methods. So who else pitched in the day before the match with?
Magnus was always sort of not part of the team, but both in 2007 when Vichy won the sort of round robin in Mexico, but also in 2008 before Kramnik, and now 2010 before Topalov, he would come by. The training camp in Bad Soden, where Vichy sort of have a small flat. He's actually quarantined there at the moment, if I'm informed correctly, and sort of play some training games. And it worked well for both parties. I mean, it can sound strange, but it was a good solution. I mean, Vichy needed someone strong to play training games against. And, you can play against some of the seconds, but, they're supposed to be weaker than you, and they definitely were. And also, they were heavily into the details of the openings. And what we really wanted to test is to, play the new ideas and systems we have prepared and see how they work against the surprised opponent. And there it was basically jackpot to have someone like Magnus, who is, he is a very strong player and stronger and stronger at the time. And, not so much into details in the opening, so he would be very happy to come. and play training games, and he will be surprised and he will fight the best. And like this, Vichy could start sort of feeling comfortable with his openings, and Magnus got some free information about opening three and gets to play some training games with the world champion. And that worked very well. I mean, okay, in 2010, Magnus was maybe already the highest rated and strongest player in the world. So there, 2010, yes. So there, I mean, it was much more competitive in a way, and maybe we were a bit afraid of, well, what happens if Vichy actually starts losing heavily? Will he lose all kind of confidence? But I think the match was kind of equal. Also, it helped that Vichy was the much better prepared and such. And they stayed like 3 days together there, and they played chess in the day, and in the evenings, me and Magnus might play some computer games and stuff. But he was very friendly. But, well, during the match, I would also get a bit in touch with Magnus too. Get a bit of help, but not a lot. But I mean, before game 12, I think at some point, we had some kind of problems. And especially at night at some point, Magnus had access to all Kasparov's opening notes. And somehow, Vichy would talk with Kasparov, but sort of to call him in the middle of the night to get him to check his notes, we couldn't really do. And that I was using Magnus for a couple of times. But also, just on a friendly basis. But he was much less involved. The one who really cared a lot was Kramnik. And, McShane, as we will speak, but probably a little bit later, I guess.
Yeah. So what time of day? So it's the middle of the night. You guys are working.
Not the middle of the night yet, I would guess, because, I mean, here we are distributing. Okay, we are gathering information. Everything actually looks fine. We will eat as we always do, and we will talk with Vichy, and everything seems to be doing great. I mean, Catalan was never a problem. Kramnik has solved bishop f4, bishop g5 has actually happened. We were never to worry about because we had some idea. And then the only decision left was should we play Nimzowitsch or should we play 1d4, d5? And the choice was to play 1d4, d5. And everything seemed covered. So, I mean, Vichy would leave us, I guess, around midnight. And the status would be that everything is actually looking good. And Vichy would go to sleep with, a good state of mind. Or, well, I say to go to sleep. I have no idea what he did. Probably he would go and watch a couple of comedies with Aruna, his wife, to sort of relax down. But from our perspective, he was going to sleep, and we will not see him for the next 10 hours. And basically, the deal was that, this is the areas we have to deliver, and they have to be ready when he comes for breakfast tomorrow at 9:30 or whatever. And we had 10 hours to finish the work. But at that time, it seemed like, it's no big deal. Everything seems to be working fine.
And what time was the game the following day?
I think the game was at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock. I think two o'clock, but it could actually have been 1 o'clock also. I'm not completely sure. It's a good point. Maybe it was 1 o'clock, and the routine would be that we have a morning session, then Vichy would go away, he would shower, he would lie down and relax, and then I think from maybe 12 to 12:30 we will go over sort of the, let's say, rehearsal of opening lines, and he will take the car to the game and go and play. And maybe actually the game was starting at 1 o'clock. I'm not 100% sure. It's 1 or 2 o'clock, sort of. But there was a very sort of strict routine. And especially as in the first two games, Vichy got into trouble because he misremembered some open preparation. We started to have a routine that the last half hour before he had to leave, we would sort of have drills where we were going through, okay, this is what's important in this area, this is what's important in that area, and so on. So we had to sort of fit things into that schedule.
And Peter, was there any concern at all that Topalov might spring like e4 or the English out of the blue, or was that just not even on the table?
Well, English was luckily taken care of because, we wanted to play the move order with d4, d5. So after c4, you can play e6. I think we did a bit there. I think earlier in the match, before every black game, we would still look a bit at e4. But I think for this final game, we didn't think about it, no. I think we had decided, who knows why, but that we wanted to play Vichy to play the French, and I think he would have played it for the 12th game. And looking at the lines with modern computers, it's not such a pleasant sight, so maybe Topalov should have tried that. But I think at that point, we thought that Topalov felt he was putting so much pressure on Vichy's repertoire that it would be very strange if he had changed. And with hindsight, it would have been a brilliant decision. But, Topalov really felt his strategy was paying off. I mean, Vichy was playing one dubious strategy with black after the other, and he was getting into trouble and such. And well, he's been very, I mean, I think he lost game 8. In game 10, he was close to losing. Why would you change your strategy for game 12, right? That takes, I mean, infinite courage, basically. So I don't think it was something we paid a lot of attention to. But again, as we just said, Vichy is kind of a perfectionist, so probably we had a bit, but I don't think much now.
Okay, yeah, I guess that makes sense. I mean,
yeah, it's
good to be able to game that out and make sure you have your bases covered.
Mm-hmm. So basically, we were in good spirits there, and things seems to work out. But then, of course, panic seemed to sort of hit there. I think, well, we had basically sort of distributed work. I think that, for instance, Bishop F4, Ganguly was responsible for, Bishop G5 was Wojtasek. And, well, then Catalan was probably me, but we didn't take it too serious. And then there was the D4, D5, C4, E6 move order was Kasim, but also me joining in. And there, suddenly, we hit a complete roadblock. Well, the system is called the Ubilava system. It's well named after Vichy's longtime second former second and trainer. And I mean, the funny thing is basically that the 10 years I worked with Vichy before the match, this Ubilava system was working fantastically for Black. Then all the time after this game, it was also working well. But suddenly, there it was collapsing, and. Well, you can imagine the situation, right, that, well, there is some problem around move 14. I mean, well, Kasim Janov had discovered some move he got nervous about, and we tried to solve it, and we couldn't really. I mean, well, I tried to help a lot. It didn't work. I think I asked Magnus after midnight, please, can you actually check Kasparov's notes? Maybe there is something here. And Magnus very nicely went and checked the notes. He says, no, it's not mentioned. They're okay. Then we put Kramnik on it. He couldn't solve it either. And basically, you can see that, well, we start dragging in all kind of resources. We ask maybe Surya, can you come and analyze Radek as well? So, I mean, this kind of sore spot suddenly sucks in all the attention from everybody. And, well, sometimes this can go horribly wrong. I mean, before game 10 in Bonn, we got completely paranoid about some obscure move in some line of the Vienna. And of course, Kramnik went somewhere else and played an Imswindian, and Wisley lost horribly because we had completely ignored that. And we were afraid of doing it the same again. But the problem is just that it becomes some kind of, you know, it's very difficult just to say, okay, that's a pity. It doesn't work, but, you know, let's not worry too much about it. I mean, it starts absorbing all kind of energy. So this sort of status that everything was great around midnight just got worse and worse. Well, we asked Carlsen, as I said, but he looked at it and said, okay, this is way too difficult for me. And he went to sleep because, well, he was not a paid second or anything like that. But Kramnik tried really hard, but he couldn't solve it. And me and Kasim was trying a lot, and Kasim came up with some kind of idea, and I looked at it afterwards here many years later. Maybe it worked, maybe it didn't. But there, it was clear the complete panic set in. And I think around 5 o'clock in the night, me and Wojtasek decided, okay, we're simply too tired. We cannot think anymore. So the deal was that we should go to sleep and come back at 8 o'clock. So, I mean, go to sleep means 3 hours of sleep, right? That we should get a short break. Maybe we'll have a new perspective. And the rest of the team would work as hard as they could to solve it. Because, well, the nightmare scenario was that, well, we knew that in 5 hours, Vichy is going to walk into the door. And we would much rather tell him, okay, we have a great repertoire. Just look at this. Than to tell him, okay, yeah, you have a kind of important game today, but we have no clue what you're going to play in the opening, right? That would be a pity. So we basically gave up. There. As I explained, the move order we wanted to play was d4, d5. But you could also play d4, knight, f6. And Kramnik decided on his own that, well, these guys are not going to solve this problem, or at least there's a risk. So Kramnik decided on his own just to start working on a Nimso-Indian repertoire. This was not at all sort of what we agreed with Vichy, but well, you can't really tell Kramnik to sort of stay to the plan. I mean, well, he's the ex-world champion. So Kramnik actually produced a very nice repertoire in the Nimso-Indian. And, well, we could have given that to Vichy. It was actually a very good plan B. And it also shows Kramnik that he understands that, well, okay, this can go wrong. This is a brilliant alternative. But it's also very dedicated to have a ex-world champion and maybe the best theoretician in the world who starts on his own at 5 o'clock at night for something he's not paid to try to create some kind of a repertoire, right? But, well, Kasim kept working on the problem and he got help from Luke McShane. Well, Luke McShane was, well, I guess you know him. He's sort of an extremely talented chess player, but has somehow decided not to be fully chess professional. So he was sort of a bit in and out of the chess world. And I think he was involved in one of the camps before the match and also came to my place for a week to sort of help a bit with preparation. And well, he was willing to sort of just help for the fun of it, basically. And I think around 6-7, at night or at morning, but for him night, because he's been working through the night, he managed to actually crack the problem. And I looked at it with the computer nowadays, and McShane's solution just works. I mean, it's a complicated position. I mean, well, this is an audio show, so it's difficult to explain, right? But White has sort of has an exchange and a pawn for two pieces, but White's sort of Black's position is somehow confined. But you have to play rook g8 and g5, and then you hit the bishop on f4, and the rooks come to g6, and your king escapes to g7 and such. Well, it's a brilliant solution. But also, well, the problem is that everybody is on no sleep. It's 6 o'clock in the night, and somebody suggests something magical, right? Who knows if this is working or not? But I remember that I met Kasim Dzhanov around 8 to 9 in the morning. Kasim was at no sleep at the point, while I was actually allowed this three-hour break. And it was obvious he was just dead tired, but he was basically rambling off all the variations and copying the files to me and making sure I understood it, but also just wanted to run to his bed and get some sleep, right? Because, well, he was dead at the time. But somehow, well, it managed to save it, but it was basically, it was very close. And, we had the Kramnik backup, but that would have freaked out Vichy because he was not going to plan. So somehow Kasim Dzhanov and especially McShane managed to solve our problems. And, they managed also to tell it to me. So I had like 1 hour from 8 to 9. I could sort of calmly sit down and copy the files, sort of knead them up, make sure that there were nothing was blundered, and put everything in nice to the file. And then, well, at some point, Vichy came in. I said, so how are things doing? He said, no problem. Same status as last night. There's nothing to absolutely worry about, right? And we could sort of calmly explain him that, well, here you do this, here you do that. And, well, from Vichy perspective, it looked like, well, nothing has changed, right? He left at 10 o'clock in the evening. Then he came to me again next morning, 9 o'clock. I remember that, the hotel would bring their trolleys with food to the suite. So we would sit there and have omelette and drink orange juice and talk very calmly about things. But it was a complete mess. And people was basically in tears a few hours before because nothing was working and such. And, I mean, we had the best resources you could possibly have in terms of human resources, but even sort of Kramnik couldn't solve it. And then McShane managed just in the end before we, had to present it to Vichy and such. So it was a very strange experience there. And with hindsight, probably, I mean, as you said, we completely obsessed about something that was not too likely to happen and such. But I think you lose perspective in these situations. And we had like 6 persons who thought that this was the most important thing in the world to sort of solve these kind of areas and such. And I don't know if we did, but it held up quite nicely. And then we could basically go back to our old routines with that. It was a normal game. As I said, I was eating breakfast with Vichy, and then later Kasim Dzhanov would have gotten her sleep to come back, so would Ganguly and such, and we would have our exactly normal routine. The game would take its course and such. But it was a very weird night, I would say, in many ways. But
it's like one of those movie scenes where like the teenagers have a party while the parents aren't home. And then they
something like that. Yeah, it's true. I mean, no, it looked, you're right. Yeah, someone just managed to clean up in time.
I do think Vichy said in his book that when you briefed him in the morning that you said, well, there was a huge crisis, but it's fine.
Yeah, maybe also I was so happy it was solved that I think I told him that you have a repertoire, but you actually didn't 2 hours ago. Right. And that was unprofessional, but I was just so relieved. But there was also, I mean, you can imagine Well, I tried to put a lot of pride in actually helping him, but at 5 o'clock, I just had no energy left in my body. So I just decided, okay, stop it. I'm going to leave. I'm hoping someone else will solve it for me, right? And well, they did. And I was very happy about that. And well, I could do what I'm probably best at, sort of organizing it and preparing stuff for Vichy and such. But it's true that you're right. I actually told him that, it wasn't so good, but now it is. And he will take that with stoic calmness. And well, Aruna would be there. No, we just had a pleasant breakfast there. Exact same place where people were going nuts quite early and such. But well, I think also maybe I wanted to praise the rest of the team because they did a hell of a lot of job to solve the problem. But I think also it gave him some confidence that everybody was going out of their way to try and help him in that way and such. And especially Kramnik and McShane, who the rest of us, we were at least paid seconds, right? The other one was just doing him a favor, right? So that was interesting.
It's better than waking up, as you say, and being told that you're going to play the Nimzo Indian.
With hindsight, I would have liked to see his reaction. But at that point, it wasn't my priority. But who knows? Also, the way I tell things, it sounds like the opening is very decisive. I think, obviously, it's not. But, that's what the seconds are there for and such. And that's what we cared a lot about. And,
it is sometimes decisive. But exactly.
I think also because Vichy chose it to be because he thought he had an edge there. And also, that was the kind of player he was at the time. While you were right that other times it's not. But I think for him, it wasn't in many ways.
Yeah. So to sort of wrap things up, Peter, let's get to the game. So so how does it feel from a seconds perspective? I mean, generally once a game starts, but especially this game, did you just go to sleep or were you so wired that you had to watch?
No, I can't sleep during the games. Actually, I think it's unprofessional that you can't sleep, but I mean, maybe I'm a fan, but also I feel a bit responsible. So, you sit there and you watch. Also, this was game 12. So you could argue that, there is three scenarios. Either he wins or loses, and then it doesn't matter because the match is over. Or if it's a draw, then there's a playoff, but there's actually one more night to sleep. So here, relaxing wasn't so important. But also, it was extremely exciting to sit and watch. But, that would be my style. I think Ganguly just slept through the whole game. How he managed to do that, I have absolutely no idea. I thought it was an extremely tense moment. But, respect to him, he was getting ready to prepare for a tiebreak. And, then I would mainly sit there with Wojtasek, but also with Kasim some of the time. But, of course, it's a bit selfish. But as a second, the opening phase is extremely important. You want to see how it's going because, that's the area you're responsible for. And, now or seconds maybe sounds kind of experience, but this was the first game we were in this kind of situation, right? I mean, the first match, he won quite easily, even though I said it was nerves, but he won it with the 2 points cushion. Well, here, if you want to get into history of chess, you just have to spoil the preparation and he loses game 12, right? Everything is at stake here. So, of course, we were nervous here, but the opening phase went kind of well. And I think at some point, you can see Topalov starts thinking and Vichy is still in his preparation, we felt that, this is not too bad. I mean, then you start rooting for the result, but you understand at least we didn't fuck up heavily. Pardon my language.
No worries.
Yeah.
But that's how it felt. How many moves of preparation ended up being played after all of the drama?
Something like 17 to 18 moves, if I remember correctly. But I was a very forced blind. Actually, maybe we got to around move 20, I would say, or maybe move 19. But, the point is, some lines, how many moves? It's not such a relevant question because... it's more how many unknown moves happened. And here they played some kind of Lasker variation where the first 15 moves is kind of common. And we had some kind of twist at move 17 or 18 that led to Vichy having the worst pawn structure, but having quite some compensation for it. So, we had decided that during preparation that this is not too bad, maybe while it's a bit better, but it looks extremely drawish. And we thought, our assumption is that Vichy is the best player in the world. We thought, if he gets to this part, Vichy is going to make the draw rather effortlessly. So that was the plan. We were definitely expecting after 1 hour that it's going to be a playoff, and that's going to be fun. But that was the assumption, yeah.
And you guys were fairly confident about his chances in a playoff.
Well, that's how everybody was trying to perceive it. I think we just took it as you're black, and we had suffered through with black all the match. I mean, well, we would rather that he won. He actually did. We were just trying to escape and survive. I mean, to evaluate is Vichy had, 50% or 70% or 90% or whatever, I don't think that was matters a lot for us. I mean, had Vichy been white, it would, you saw Magnus sometimes with, once or twice with white, play cautiously and make a draw because he was thought himself as a huge favorite. With white, you can start making strategical choices. With black, what can you do, right?
Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, Vichy was completely dominant and rapid. And I think we saw him as the favorite. But Kasymjanov had a good point, and I think still a valid point, that, I mean, Vichy would be the favorite in any rapid match with Topalov. But this is not a rapid match. This is a playoff for the world championship. It is something different. I mean, this is about nerves and, then it's a different situation. I still think Vichy would be the favorite also. Why would he have worse nerves than Topalov and such? But I think Kasim makes a very relevant point. Well, Kasim makes a lot of relevant points that... It's not the same. I mean, just to talk about who's the best rapid player doesn't make so much sense here. It's about, who is up to the moment, who has the best nerves and such. And that would be rather uncomfortable. I mean, you saw in 2012, Vichy actually managed to win a match in the playoff against Gelfand, but he wasn't the dominant rapid player that he used to be there. So, who knows what would have happened. But I think, we would have been happy to get a draw, but that was because he was black and because we had suffered so much in the match. Not that we thought that, okay, rapid, it's going to be a walk in the park.
Right. Just trying to survive.
Yeah, basically.
So I in my chess base had Geary had annotated this game, and he had a couple of notes about the opening. And from what I read again, I can't remember if it was in Mind Master or the Anon Files, but a young Geary may have pitched in a bit too before the match.
Yeah, he was actually joining at some point, and it's a bit embarrassing, especially Anish, but I forgot which match it was for. That was for the Topalov match, right?
I
think so. Yeah. No. He was there for a couple of days. But I think Geary himself on Twitter, that's where he normally communicates, right?
right.
Said that that his participation was a failure. That was a bit harsh. I mean, it depends on the level of expectation. I think with your thought, we're going to bring in a young, talented kid to have a bit of fun for a couple of days and play sort of some training games with Vichy. I don't think we were expecting him to pull miracles in any way. I mean, it was just he was a very nice young kid who came and had a couple of good days there. So I think Geary was a bit hard to pass on himself, but you're right that... And I forgot he was part of the camps, of course, maybe gives away that, he wasn't the one, he was not like Kramnik, who was solving all of our problems and spending all his time. But he was not supposed to, really. He was just a young teenager, right?
Okay. So in his annotations, which I believe were written shortly after the match, although I'm not sure, but he mentioned that he predicted that it would be a Queen's Gambit decline. I don't know about publicly or whatever, but I think he just sort of, game theoried out that would be a logical choice. But he also mentioned that that Vichy ended up following a German correspondence game from 2000 up through move 21, bishop a6, and then he at which point Vichy accidentally played a novelty. And a good one at that, Geary said.
So. Yeah, that could be. I mean, we did have some inspiration. Actually, I mean, it was said that we never considered the Queen's Gambit decline before the match. I don't think it's technically true. I think in the beginning of the match, we are tossing up a lot of ideas. And I think exactly this line in the Lasker was mentioned in some new in chess yearbook that was lying around, and I remember reading it and such. And I think in the beginning of the match, we were sort of, it could be that. We were still sort of, tossing around ideas. But I remember very specifically that I left the camp for 3 days my girlfriend, now wife, is living in Lithuania, so I was allowed to go there for a short holiday. But when I came back, I was just told, okay, big news, by the way, we're playing the Slav. Okay. I made a note of never leave the camp, because then decisions apparently are going to be taken without you. But so we had a bit of work, and I think actually that included, there was some article in a new chess yearbook where we have spotted that this line kind of existed and such. But I don't think we had any serious notes, and we basically started working from scratch on that. But I mean, well, we had noted it existed, but also basically, I mean, well, it's very hard to find something that hasn't been played by someone ever before, right? I mean, there is not billions of games, but tens of millions of games, right? More or less everything exists, right? So, well, you have to find something that suits you. But this line was very common sense, and it's a bit surprising Tupolev hadn't prepared something sharper, in my opinion.
Okay. So not to speak for GM Geary, but one could infer that when he says he accidentally played a novelty, he probably means that Vichy didn't even know he was following this game.
Exactly. That could very well be. That you also see quite typically that someone, you know, online commentators will say, okay, I mean, well, this move is not a novelty because it was played in the, you know, Siberian Youth Championship 3 years ago, I mean, in the under 12 section. And no, that can happen, but it's still, I think, what matters if it's a novelty at top level or something like that. It depends, but I don't think we were following that game you mentioned specifically. I mean, I remember we had seen some games or this theoretical article by a Polish player called Grabaczyk, we were following that.
Okay. And then he ends up, of course, winning in a spectacular fashion, although with probably some help from Tupolev along the way.
Yeah, Tupolev could force a draw. I mean, well, Vichy was offering a repetition, and we really thought Tupolev would take it. But I think, maybe his evaluation was different of Rapid. I mean, if let's say Tupolev maybe thought that, okay, I'm a huge underdog in Rapid, so let me try and force events when I'm white here in game 12. And well, that's a very viable strategy. I mean, Tupolev has been a lot criticized for what he did, but it really comes down to, do you like your chances in Rapid or not? And also, well, Tupolev played some very sharp moves, but I think afterwards he said he missed one move by Vichy. And if I recall correctly, well, that move by Vichy was winning, but had that move not existed, it would actually be very difficult for Vichy. Well, I mean, it becomes a bit weird, but you can argue that, it was not that Tupolev took a bad gamble. The problem was that Tupolev miscalculated and he missed one of Vichy's resources, and that made a huge difference. But even then, it was very, very sharp, right? I mean, I remember that I think when the time control was finished, people started sending emails and congratulating us. And that was obviously freaking us out, right? Because the match was not right. I mean, I think the same actually happened in Mexico. I think with two rounds to go, Vichy was getting congratulatory emails. That was completely freaking him out, obviously. But that's normal for fans to do. I mean, it's responsibility of the players and the seconds just to shut themselves out of such, right? Chess is a strange sport. I mean, the last hour of the game in Sofia is in many ways pretty boring because Vichy is completely winning, but just taking his time to make absolutely sure he doesn't mess up. And that takes some time. And that's how it is. So, well, you can say it was a bit of an anticlimax. But, we were getting ourselves ready, but there was like half an hour's transport from maybe 20 minutes from the hotel to the playing hall. But sort of, someone suggested, should we go there before the game is over? And I said, no, just no way. It's not like, I don't believe that you can jinx it, but still, you don't do it because I would be rather bad if we went there and the game was still going on and such, right? I mean, imagine us going to the playing hall and wish he can see us there. He would, he understands, of course, that we are going there to celebrate. That would kind of put some pressure on him, right? So, we had to wait until he was basically over, which luckily was at some point.
Yeah, and as you say, it was a sharp position. So to like a casual player like me, I mean, of course he's technically, I mean, he's clearly winning, but I mean, both kings are exposed. You know?
Yeah, he has to calculate, and there is some, I mean, later there was some risk of fortresses and such. I mean, when you look at the computer, you're completely winning. But we're talking about they have played 5 hours, but also they have, this is game number 12, and everything is at stake. I mean, it's just one bad move, and things are completely different. So, Vichy is good. He didn't do it. But, of course, it was very nervous there. But, I mean, no, as Chiavarino mentioned, there has been so much tension and such. I mean, it wouldn't be completely illogical if someone would suddenly snap and do something insane. But luckily, it wasn't Vichy.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what some people have intimated about what Topalov did with, you know.
Yeah. I think that is too harsh, to be honest. I think it's just he missed a good defensive move for Vichy. You can, of course, say that intuitively what he did is insane. But again, if you look at it concretely, it comes down to one or two extremely precise moves by Vichy. And again, also, it's, you know, if Topalov thought, okay, I'm taking a 50-50 gamble, that's a good decision if he thinks he's an underdog in Rapid. So, but no, with hindsight, it's very easy to say that what Topalov did was bad. But I think it's, well, Topalov is Topalov. He takes aggressive, risky decisions, and that cost him in the end.
Yeah, and when I talked to Chiavarinov, he told the story, which I think has been suggested elsewhere as well, that Topalov was actually superstitious about the possible playoff.
Yeah, it was going to be on Friday the 13th or something like that.
Right, and he had lost another critical match.
Against Kramnik, for sure. No, I mean, believe it or not, but such things might actually matter, right?
I mean, once the thought enters your head, it's like you can't get it out.
You can't unthink it, right? I mean, also you have to make up some story why you did something stupid afterwards, but it could be a mix of that. It's a comfortable explanation, but there's definitely also some truth in it, right? To round things up, I mean, well, normally when Vichy won, we would be quite happy, but Sofia was something special. I mean, that was this kind of hatred between maybe not teams, but at least officially, right? So, I mean, no, you know, there was some celebrations. I mean, not like a football match, but I mean, well, we were actually hugging each other and such, which sounds very weird for a chess scenario, right? All right, but there was a bit of celebration. I remember giving high five to someone I met, you know, when we were running out of the suite to meet the other team members and such. So, I mean, let's say for half a minute we celebrated like football players and we thought, oh, this is actually chess, let's try and behave again. But sort of there was some kind of emotions getting out there for a while. But I remember it was a 20-minute taxi ride to the playing hall so we could cool down and become normal human beings again. But also, it's also strange, but I mean, well, I guess in football, no, there is a lot of physical activities. Here, it's like, well, three long weeks, and then suddenly all the energy disappears. Also, I mean, as I said, Kasabjanov maybe had 1 hour of sleep. I had like three. I mean, you suddenly realize that you're tired afterwards when everything is. I mean, when the adrenaline starts leaving the body, you just get this very empty feeling, basically. So, I mean, no, nothing too dramatic happened after that, I would say.
Yeah, I would. I mean, not. I obviously. Never lived or never will live anything like that, but I would imagine it's a bit, I don't want to say a letdown, but I mean,
it's an anticlimax in many ways.
Exactly.
Because I remember the first time was in 2007. I mean, I so much wanted Vichy to be the world champion. I worked really hard as a second, but when he actually won in Mexico, I thought, oh, that was nice. And then, no, I'm not really going to go to the press conference. I'm just going to have a nap before dinner. That was it. But there's a lot of satisfaction. But it's very different from, you know, football, where you will just start running around and behave strangely. I mean, it's a different mentality. But I think also it's a different sport. Well, I'm not a player. I'm a second. So it's a bit different. But even the players, you see that they seem to act kind of, you know, shake hands and smile a bit when they have won the world championship. Right? So...
Okay, well, Peter, congratulations on your team winning that match.
Yeah, I think Anand won it, right? But well, no, it was very interesting and also you can say it was pretty hard. So, well, we stayed together for one more match, but then somehow you can see Kasim is with Caruana now and such, right? So,
yeah, you guys were too good to work together for too long.
he got tired of me. I don't know, but you'll have to ask him about that. Yeah. So, no.
Okay. Well, thank you. This has been an amazing glimpse behind the curtain, Peter.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was, thanks a lot for letting me relive some memories here on the 10-year anniversary day off.
Anytime. Any world championship you want to relive, Peter, I'm here for you.
Well, I hope there will be more memories to relive. Let's do that, okay?
Yeah, let's start by just having a world championship and then you can
winning it. That would be a good start, yeah. Okay.
Okay, well, excellent, Peter. And people can follow you on Twitter. I know you've been follow chess has been showing the games like as if they're happening now.
That's true. Yeah,
so it's fun when you post the screenshots and comments. And
Now I will probably post something for game 12, but I think now comes this phase withdrawal and then it suddenly is over there. So that should be fun, yeah? So good. Okay.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Peter. Yeah. This has been a ton of fun.
You too. Okay, take good care.
Special thanks to my producer, Matthew Passy, and thanks to you all for continuing to listen to and spread the word about Perpetual Chess. You can spread the word on Twitter. Follow me. I'm @BenEfficial1. You can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group and continue the dialogue about each interview after it is released. I also want to thank the people who've written a few new reviews on Apple Podcasts. That's good to see. Reviews on other podcast platforms and YouTube are also appreciated. But of course, most of all, I would like to thank the people who provide financial support to the show, especially these days as a lot of our lives are in upheaval. We're stuck at home. There's work changes and all that stuff. So it means the world to me that you guys have stuck with me and even in some cases added new support in these crazy times. So thanks. I really appreciate it. For anyone who's able to support, it is the Perpetual Chess Patreon page where you can donate through PayPal if you go to perpetualchesspod.com. So with that out of the way, first of all, of course, I would like to thank the sponsor of the show, Chessable. And I also would like to give extra special thanks to the following people and entities for their support. They include Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Apprentice Twitch channel, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porto, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, Dan O'Hanlon, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Greg Natel, Greg Shahadi, Guven Manet, Jens Green, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John Cromarty, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, Lorraine Dore, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Moonmaster 9000, Peter Sodi, Reuven Fisher, Seattle Chess Club, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryan of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, and I also would like to give thanks to the following people and entities: Aaron Waffler, Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, FM Andre Tarakov, Andrew Perry, Aniti Deer, Better Chess Training, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wayne Scott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Chris Lott, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Courtney Fry, David Bleskacek, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Lucas of the U.S. Chess Federation, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Douglas Matthew, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ethan Smith, Ian Mason, I am Elect, or possibly not I am Elect, Donnie Ariel Esquire, Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Francis Letart Lavoie, Francis Tortorice, MD, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Jacob Kovach, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Bonastia, James Murr, Jason Anfang, Jason Woolham, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Jerry Wells, Jim Ratliff, JJ Stranad, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman of the U.S. Chess Federation, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jordan Goodwin, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Reiforth, Laura Belyovsky, Martin Knudsen, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Alert, Miguel Araspati, Mike Clem, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Solin, Neil Bruce, Olaf Mueller Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbach, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott Dougherty, Scott McKinnon, Sebastian Finsterwater, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatia Vabrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tom Edsel, Thomas Kolmanich, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Wayne Beam, William Brock, William Juniper, William Hogarth, William Peterson, FM Zhao Chang of chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Soryanov. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I will catch you all soon.
Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.